sugars. Mum swore that barley sugars kept motion sickness at bay. So for me, the taste of barley sugar is now the taste of being sick. The paper bag with its grim cargo, the lurch onto the roadside, the wiping your hands on the dead brown grass. We have entered the city proper now, sweeping through the glass canyons where the heat hangs in a lilac haze. I open the sweets tin. Inside are 6 neatly rolled joints. Clearing my throat, I adopt the tone of a Radio 4 announcer. Company policy is quite clear that the consumption of any illegal drugs on the premises of Edwin Morgan Forster is specifically forbidden, and... We're nearly there, so I'd better hurry up. Have you got a light, Winston? 11:31 a.m. Research for my meeting hampered because the typeface of the Wall Street Journal refuses to keep still. All squirmy black lines, the market returns page looks like the ugly bug's ball. Completely pathetic. Feel like a maiden aunt after a schooner of Vicarage sherry. Motherhood, or abstinence brought on by motherhood, has wrecked my capacity to enjoy drugs of any kind, except the occasional desperate slug of Calpol. I manage to walk into the meeting room okay, but once I'm inside, the walls keep receding into infinite reflections of themselves, like an Escher print. Every time I stand up to change a slide, I have to grab the edge of the table and tip my head slightly to one side to steady the horizon. Feel like a human spirit level. When I open my mouth to address the 12 fund managers around the table, the voice that comes out sounds confident enough. But then I discover I have only a vague idea who's talking and none at all about what she's going to say next. It's like being a ventriloquist of myself. Nonetheless, a profound feeling of relaxation enables me to disregard the opinions of my colleagues and make the investment choices that will become policy for the entire company starting tomorrow. Bonds or equities? No problem. UK or Japan? Hell, only a fool would hesitate over that one. Halfway through the meeting, Andrew McManus, Scots, ruggabugger, shoulders like a Chesterfield sofa, gives a self-important little cough and announces that he hopes all present will forgive him, but he has to slip away early because Catriona, his daughter, has this swimming gala and he promised her that Daddy would be there. Everyone around the table reacts as though this is the most normal thing in the world. The younger guys, who think they may one day get around to having kids, but only when the Porsche Boxster comes complete with a nappy-changing shelf, don't flinch. The other fathers bask in conspiratorial new dad smugness. I see Momo, who is single and knows no better, mouth, sweet. Even Celia Harmsworth composes her wicked queen features into an approximation of a smile and says, "Oh, how marvelous, Andrew. You're so hands-on." As though McManus had single-handedly driven the Dow up 150 points. This is the same woman who in December tried to have me court-martialed following my trip to a school carol concert. During client time. Observing that I am the only colleague not to join in the cooing approbation, Andrew shrugs helplessly and says, "You know how it is, Kate," slips into his jacket and out of the room. Indeed, I do know how it is. Man announces he has to leave the office to be with his child for short recreational burst and is hailed as selfless, doting, paternal role model. Woman announces she has to leave the office to be with child who is on sickbed and is damned as disorganized, irresponsible, and showing insufficient commitment. For father to parade himself as a father is a sign of strength. For mother to out herself as a mother is a sign of appalling vulnerability. Don't you just love equal opportunities? To Deborah Richardson from Kate Reddy. Just chaired meeting where fellow manager announced he had to leave to attend daughter's swimming gala. Practically knighted on the spot for services to parenthood. If I tried that, Rod would have me executed and my dripping bloody head stuck on the ramparts of Bank of England as a warning to other women slackers. It's so unfair. I'm coming to conclusion that career girl bollocks is one generation only trick. We are living proof that it can't work, aren't we? Forget higher education. Think we should send our girls to catering college, where they can learn to make decorative floral centerpieces and a delicious supper for two. Then they can marry a man who will pay for them to stay at home and have pedicures. Urgent. Please remind me what was drawback to that way of life again. To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Once upon a time, in a land far away, a beautiful, independent, self-assured princess happened upon a frog as she sat contemplating ecological issues on the shore of an unpolluted pond in a verdant meadow near her castle. The frog hopped onto the princess's lap and said, "Sweet lady, I was once a handsome prince until an evil witch cast a spell on me. One kiss from you, however, and I will turn back into the dapper young prince that I am. Then, my sweet, we can marry and set up house in yon castle, where you can prepare my meals, clean my clothes, bear my children, and forever feel grateful and happy doing so." That night, dining on a repast of lightly sautéed frog's legs, the princess chuckled to herself and thought, "I don't fucking think so." Men today can only be better fathers than their fathers, simply by knowing how to change a nappy or figuring out which hole you stick the bottle in. These things mark them out as more capable parents than any previous generation. But women can only be worse mothers than our mothers, and this rankles because we are working so very hard and we are doomed to fail. At Edwin Morgan Forster, the desks of men with children are dense with photographs of their offspring. Before you get to the computer and the blotter, you have to negotiate a 3-day event course of family portraits. Leather frames, mottled crocodile frames, double steel frames with a copper hinge, witty perspex cubes. A missing tooth here, a soccer goal there. That skiing trip in February where Sophie wrapped her red scarf around Dad's neck and they both turned to face the camera with Steinway smiles. A man is allowed to advertise the fact that he is a father. It's a sign of strength, a sign he is a good provider. The women in the offices of EMF don't tend to display pictures of their kids. The higher they go up the ladder, the fewer the photographs. If a man has pictures of kids on his desk, it enhances his humanity. If a woman has them, it decreases hers. Why? Because he's not supposed to be home with the children. She is. I used to have a photo of Ben and Emily on my desk. Rich snapped it just after the baby had learned to sit up. Em was sitting behind, clutching him round the middle with fierce pride. He was bubbling up as though life was one big joke, and he'd just heard the punchline for the first time. I kept the photo on my desk for a few weeks, but each time I caught the children looking at me, I had the same thought. You are providing for them, but you are not bringing them up. So the picture's in the drawer now. Last year, I went to this lecture by an American chief executive at the London Business School. She said she was going to train her daughters up as geishas. The real future for women was as nurturers and men-pleasers. There was nervous laughter in the room. She was joking, wasn't she? She was beautiful, and she was incredibly smart, and I don't think she was joking. All I knew was that I didn't want my mother's life. I didn't need a role model to teach me that being dependent on some man was debilitating, maybe even dangerous. But will Emily really want my life? When she looks at her mummy, who does she see? If she ever sees her mummy. Back in the 70s, when they were fighting for women's rights, what did they think equal opportunities meant? That women would be entitled to spend as little time with their kids as men do? 12:46 p.m. Chowzat is the high-tech cafeteria installed by EMF last year in the basement as part of its attempt to look less like a bank and more like a nightclub. The cafe is meant to have a funky post-industrial ambiance, but the effect is a lot like an airport coffee lounge. I am still lightly stoned after the joint accepted in a moment of madness this morning. What could I be thinking of? As I was getting out of the car, Winston invited me to join him at a concert a fortnight on Sunday. "Might find it not totally my scene," he said. "The music was a bit overwhelming, but he thinks it would do me good." As the proud fortress fund manager composed her polite but frosty refusal, I opened my mouth and out fell the word yes. Presumably, I now have a date at a rave with my new drug dealer. What the hell am I going to tell Richard? As the weed wears off, I feel both nauseous and ravenous. Weigh up the rival merits of the jumbo blueberry muffin and its dainty local sister, lemon and sesame seed. Buy both. I'm stuffing alternate fistfuls into my mouth when I look up and see familiar brick-red features glowering down at me.
"Jesus, Katie, you're not eating for two, are you? Got enough trouble in that department with candy."
Rod Task. "No," I splutter, shooting blueberry bullets across the table. Rod tells me he needs me to go to New York to do a pitch to some brokers on Wednesday. Wants me to give them a little TLC. This information followed by a grotesque wink.
"Next Wednesday?" "Sure, as in the day after tomorrow."
"Actually, Rod, my nanny is off sick, and I have to find a temporary to..." He cuts me off with a karate slice of the hand.
"Are you telling me you can't make it, Kate? If you can't, I'm sure Guy can handle it."
Yes, of course I can. It's just that..."
"Great. And can you take a look at this for me, sweetie? Thanks."
I study the photocopy in the lift on the way back to the 13th floor. It's an article from Investment Manager International, under the headline, "The Gender Equality Penny is Finally Dropping." Investment management firms are increasingly jumping on the bandwagon of gender equality as they realize that a more welcoming attitude towards women employees makes good business sense. Herbert George and Berryman Lowell have recently won laurels for their efforts in this area. Julia Brooking, a vice president at Herbert George, says, "The city offers fabulous opportunities for women. More are being promoted every year. Most firms have now appointed diversity coordinators." Many institutions lament, however, that while they offer great careers for women, preconceptions of antisocial working hours and macho culture are still deterrents to female applicants. Puncturing the stereotype of old boy cronyism associated with the square mile is not easy, admits Celia Harmsworth, head of human resources at Edwin Morgan Forster. Well, she should know. Seeing Celia's name in an article on gender equality is like finding Heinrich Himmler conducting a guided tour of a synagogue. Harmsworth announced that EMF, formerly considered to be one of the city's more old-fashioned outfits, has recently appointed a diversity coordinator, Catherine Reddy.
What?
35-year-old Reddy, the youngest senior director at EMF, has been tasked with identifying gender issue obstacles in the business culture. I notice that Rod has circled the phrase "gender issue obstacles." Next to it, he has scrawled,
"What the fuck is this?"
To Deborah Richardson from Kate Reddy. "Hello, hello from your borderline psychotic friend. Do you think postnatal depression can last up to 18 months after birth? If so, when does it go away? Did I mention we have rats? One ran across the floor when the in-laws were staying. Oh, and my cleaner has fired me. Came into work to discover 61 emails, pitch to do in New York City, nanny sick, only available temp is close relative of Slobodan Milosevic. Plus, I am EMF's new diversity coordinator. Have to take urgent steps to redress the firm's gender imbalance. Any idea where I can purchase some kind of automatic weapon? Can we please do that lunch? Name a day. Kisses." To Kate Reddy from Deborah Richardson. "Believe that postnatal depression can last up to 18 years after the birth, and then we have a hysterectomy and start watching old episodes of Friends from red rubber old lady chairs in gated retirement community. Don't worry, rats now very middle class. No stylish home dare be seen without one. Felix has been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Think that's what his dad suffers from too, but that could be because he's having an affair. Too knackered to care. Read in Good Housekeeping that half of all working mothers are worried relationship with husband is suffering because of a terrible time famine. What are the other half doing? 30-second blowjobs. What news of the gorgeous, unsuitable Abelhammer? You do realize that as my oldest friend, your sole role is to give me reasons to envy and disapprove of you. Lunch next Tuesday or Thursday. Kisses. 6:35 p.m. I collect Emily and Ben from Alice's house. They fall on me like famished things. Alice's nanny, Jo, is incredibly nice and says what great kids they are. How thoughtful and imaginative Emily is. Feel a burst of pride and pang of shame simultaneously as I realize how often I see them as a problem to be dealt with rather than something to be enjoyed. Must appoint a temporary nanny tonight unless I can persuade Richard to work from home or Paula makes miracle recovery. I have a total horror of asking favors on my own or my children's behalf. Reminds me of when Dad pushed me towards a woman at the bus station in Leeds one Christmas and told me to ask if she could let us have a fiver to get home because we'd run out of petrol. We didn't even have a car. But the lady was so nice about it. She gave me the money and a packet of jelly tots for myself. The sweet stuck inside my hot cheeks like ulcers. Jo says Ben has been clingy all day, and she thinks he has some kind of rash on his chest. Has he had chickenpox? No, he hasn't, but he can't have it now. Am booked on 8:30 a.m. flight to New York. 10:43 p.m. I can't believe it. I stand on the landing outside the bathroom, draped in a tiny towel, screaming for Richard. There's no hot water!
What?
He stands halfway up the stairs from the hall, his face in shadow.
Oh, they turned the water off today when the rat guy was checking the pipes. Must have flicked the switch.
I have to have my bath.
Darling, be reasonable.
His voice is parched with weariness.
I'll put it on now, and it'll be hot in 20 minutes.
Now. I need a bath now.
Kate.
He stops, looks at me as if about to say something, but then just tightens his lips and stares at me, shaking his head. What? What is it? I snap.
Kate, we can't go on like this.
Too right we can't. I have no hot water. I have rats. I have a house that is a complete tip and no one to clean it. I need to be asleep an hour ago, and I really, really, really would like there to be some hot water, Richard. I work all the hours God sends, and I live in conditions of medieval squalor. Is a bath too much to ask for? Rich reaches out an arm, but I bat it away. My tears are alarmingly hot. The temperature of the bath I'm not going to have. Must try to calm down. My husband looks wild-eyed. Why hasn't he shaved? Just now, from over our heads, comes a voice.
Ooh!
It whimpers.
Ooh!
Chapter 32. I went back too soon. 1:05 a.m. Have you ever thought how much time you waste falling asleep? Falling sounds satisfactorily fast, but you don't fall, do you? I find I have to sort of sidle up on sleep and ask if it could please let me in, like someone in the queue for a club trying to catch the eye of a doorman who is always looking the other way. 7 minutes of pillow plumping and hollowing, the obligatory tussle with a duvet. Richard likes one leg hooked outside, which pins it down like a ground sheet and leaves me barely covered. I take a herbal sleeping tablet to summon instant shut-eye. 3:01 a.m. Can't sleep for worrying that the sleeping tablet is so strong I will sleep through my alarm and miss the flight from Heathrow. I switch on the bedside light and read the paper. Next to me, Rich grunts and turns over. The foreign pages have more on the story of the American chief executive who went back to work 4 days after her twins were born. She chaired a meeting via speakerphone from her hospital bed. Her name is Elizabeth Quick. No, seriously. Sister to Hannah Haste and Isabel Imperative, presumably. Liz Quick has become a poster woman for working mothers, the article says, but opponents say motherhood will distract her from her job. I can feel my whole body crumple. Do people like Miss Quick have any idea how their valiant effort to act as though nothing has changed can be used as a stick to beat other women? God knows I can't talk. I went back too soon after Emily. I didn't know, How can you, that this new life will be almost as strange to you as it is to them? Mother and baby, newborns both. Before children, a woman's existence is divided into BC and AC. When I still had time to go to the National Gallery on Sunday afternoons, I used to like to sit in front of that Bellini Madonna, the one where she's in the foreground of a kind of farm, baked by the sun, gazing down at the lovely infant in her lap. I'd always thought it was serenity in her eyes. Now I only see exhaustion and mild puzzlement. "Christ, what have I done?" Mary asks the Son of God. But he's sleeping, full of milk, one plump arm flung in abandon over his mother's blue dress. I was the first woman on the investment floor at Edwin Morgan Forster to get pregnant. 6 months gone when James Entwistle, Rod Task's predecessor, called me into his office and said he couldn't guarantee there would be a job for me when I got back from maternity leave. You know how fast things move on with clients, Kate. It's nothing personal. Civilized, decent, erudite James. I suppose I could have quoted the legislation at him, but there's nothing they hate more than being reminded of their family-friendly policy. EMF's family-friendly policy exists so they can say they have a policy, not so people with families can invoke it. No man would ever use it anyway, so neither can any woman who wants to be taken seriously. Of course, the baby won't make any difference, James, I heard myself saying. He made a note on the jotter with his gold Cartier pen. Commitment, he wrote, and underlined it twice. Would I be wanting to scale back on my foreign clients? Of course not. I didn't know. At 32 weeks, I went to see the consultant at University College Hospital. Routine appointment. I'd missed the last one. Geneva, conference, fog. The consultant steepled his long white fingers like a cardinal and told me he was signing me off work because I was under too much pressure during the crucial weeks of fetal brain development. I said that was out of the question. I planned to work up to my due date so I could have some time at home with the baby afterwards. "I'm not really worried about you, Mrs. Shattuck," he said coolly. "I worry about the child you're carrying and the damage you could cause it." I was crying so hard that when I stepped out into Gower Street, I was nearly run over by a milk cart. So I took it easy. I took it easier. Technically, I had to stop flying at 7 months, but a taupe shift dress saw me through till 8. Bump got so damned big by the end, I had to do a 3-point turn to get out of the lift. When jokes were made in meetings about needing to reinforce the office floor to support Kate's weight, I laughed louder than anyone. Every time I walked past the dealing desk, Chris Bunce used to sing the Elephant March from Jungle Book under his breath. Up, 2, 3, 4, keep it up, 2, 3, 4. Bastard. Sitting at the computer one afternoon, stomach so stretched my skin felt it was crawling with ants, I felt a few Braxton Hickses, those practice contractions that sound like a retired colonel living in Nether Wallop. By the end, I used to dream of Colonel Hicks coming to my aid. He would carry my briefcase, and when I was standing at the bus stop on City Road, nearly keeling over from exhaustion, he would hold out a hand and say, "Will you step aboard, madam?" I did enroll in a prenatal class, but could never make it there for the 7:30 start. Ended up going to a birthing weekend in Stoke Newington, run by Beth. Oat biscuits, whale music, a pelvis made out of a coat hanger, and a baby from a stocking pulled over a tennis ball. Beth invited us to have a conversation with our vaginas. I said I wasn't on speaking terms with mine, and she thought I was joking. Laugh like a moose down a well. Richard loathed the class. He couldn't believe he had to take his shoes off, but he liked the bit with the stopwatch. You could swear he was going to be officiating at the Monaco Grand Prix. "Knowing you, Kate," he said, "you'll have the fastest contractions in history." Beth said if you did those panting little breaths she taught us, it was a way of mastering the pain. So I practiced them religiously. I practiced them secularly, at checkouts, in the bath, before bed. I didn't know. My waters broke on the escalator at bank, splashing the Burberry of a Japanese futures analyst who apologized profusely. I cancelled my client lunch on the mobile and took a cab straight to the hospital. They offered me an epidural, but I didn't take it. I was the bitch who had endangered her baby's brain development. Not having drugs was my way of showing how sorry I was, showing the baby there was something its mother would bear for it. There was an ocean of pain, and I dived into it again and again. The water was hard as wood. It smacked you like a wave hitting a deck, and each time you got to your feet, it smacked you again. After 25 hours of labor, Rich put the stopwatch down and asked the midwife if we could see a consultant. Now. Down in the operating theater, during my emergency cesarean, I heard the surgeon say, "Nothing to worry about. This will feel a bit like I'm doing the washing up in your tummy." It didn't. It felt like the baby was an oak being pulled up by the roots from claggy November earth. Tug and wrench and tug again. Finally, one of the junior doctors climbed onto the operating table, straddled me, and yanked her out by the heels. Held her up like a catch, a thing from the sea, a mermaid marbled with blood. A girl. Over the next few days, a number of bouquets arrived, but the biggest came from Edwin Morgan Forster. It was the kind of Baroque arrangement that can only be commanded by war memorials or a city expense account. There were priapic thistles 5 feet high and giant lilies that filled the air with their pepper and made the baby sneeze. A card was attached with a message written by a florist who couldn't spell. One down, free to go. God, I hated those flowers. The way they stole our air, hers and mine. I gave them to the day midwife, who slung them over her shoulder and took them home to Harleston on her scooter. After 36 hours, the night midwife, Irish, softer, more musical than her daylight counterpart, asked if she could take the baby from me so I could get some rest. When I protested, she said, "Part of being a good mum, Catherine, is having enough energy to cope." And she wheeled away my daughter, who furled and unfurled those frond-like hands in her little Perspex aquarium. Headlong, I fell down a mineshaft of exhaustion. It could have been hours later, it felt like seconds, that I heard her crying. Up till that moment, I didn't know I knew my baby's cry. But when I heard it, I knew I would always know it, would be able to pick it out from any other cry in the world. From somewhere down a brown corridor, she summoned me. Hitching the catheter over one arm and guarding my stitches with the other, I started to hobble towards her, guided by that sonar which had come as a free gift with motherhood. By the time I got to the nursery, she had stopped yelling and was staring, enthralled at a paper ceiling lantern. I have never experienced joy and fear in such a combination before. Impossible to tell where the pain stopped and the love began. "You'll have to name her," the smiling midwife chided. "We can't keep calling her baby. It's not right." I'd thought about Genevieve, but it suddenly seemed too big for the intended owner. Emily was my grandmother's name. She always made me feel safe. "Oh, Emily's lovely. Let's try it." So we tried it, and she turned her head towards her name, and it was settled. 3 weeks later, James Entwistle rang and offered me a job in strategy, a nothing job going nowhere. I accepted it gratefully and put down the phone. I would kill him later. Later, I would kill all of them. But first, I had to bathe my daughter. 9 weeks to the day of the caesarean, I was back in the office. That first morning, my mind was so disconnected that I actually dialed a number and asked if I could speak to Kate Reddy. A man said he didn't think Kate was back yet. And he was right. I reckon she wasn't really back for a year. And the old Kate, the one before children, never returned. But she did a great impersonation of being back, and maybe only a mother could have seen through her disguise. 5 days later, work told me I had to fly to Milan, and I was still breastfeeding. All weekend, I tried to get Emily to accept a bottle, coaxed and pleaded, and finally paid a woman from Fulham £100 to come and wean my daughter off me. I can remember the baby yodeling, lungs raw with fury, and Richard standing out in the garden smoking. "She'll take the bottle when she's really starving," the woman explained, and yes, she herself would prefer cash. Sometimes I think Emily has never really forgiven me. On the drive to the airport, the cab radio started playing that Stevie Wonder song, Isn't She Lovely? The one where you hear the baby crying at the start. And my blouse was soaked suddenly with milk. I didn't know. Chapter 33. The Note. 11:59 p.m. Sherborne Hotel, New York. Unbelievable. Plane got in on time, and I took a cab to the Harriet off Wall Street. The plan was to swat up for tomorrow's presentation and get a decent night's rest before strolling across the road to the World Financial Center. I should have known. The reception clerk, hopelessly young, trying to give himself a little authority in a cheap, shiny blazer, was having trouble meeting my eye. Finally, he said, "I'm afraid we have a problem, Miss Reddy. A conference. Overbooking. I am happy to offer you free accommodation at the Sherborne, Midtown. Great location, opposite our world-renowned Museum of Modern Art." "Sounds delightful, but I'm here to do business, not get a headache staring at early cubists." Ended up yelling at him, of course. "Totally unacceptable. Frequent customer, blah, blah, blah." Could see his eyes darting around for a superior to save him from the crazy Brit. As though I were mad. And I'm not mad, am I? It's these people driving you crazy with their inefficiency, wasting my precious time. The manager was incredibly apologetic, but there was absolutely nothing he could do. So by the time I get to the new hotel, it's nearly midnight. Called Richard, who was ready with a list of queries. Thank God Paul is better, so we don't have to get a temp. It's Emily's first day back at school tomorrow. Had I done the name tapes? Yes. Had I got new gym shoes? Yes. In her navy gym bag, on the peg, under the stairs. Where would he find her reading books? Red library folder. Third shelf of bookcase. Had I bought a new coat? The old one now comes up to her waist. Not yet. She will have to make do with Gap raincoat till I get back. Then I dictated the contents of her lunchbox. Pita bread, tuna and corn, no cheese. She's decided she hates cheese. And told him to remember the check for ballet, the amounts written in the diary. And he needs to give Paul the money to get Ben some new trousers. He's just had a growth spurt. Richard tells me that Em was upset going to bed. She said she wanted Mummy to take her to school because it's a new teacher. Why does he feel he needs to share that with me when there's absolutely nothing I can do about it? Says he's had an exhausting day. Tell me about it, I say back, and ching down the phone. No time to go through notes for my presentation, so I will have to wing it. Tomorrow's shaping up to be a total nightmare. To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Just got yours to say you're cancelling lunch. Again. The first 49 times it was funny. I realize you have the most disgustingly demanding job on the planet, but if we don't make time for friendship, what hope is there? Are we next going to meet after our deaths? How is the afterlife looking for you, Kate? Oh, hell. No time to reply. Wednesday, 8:33 a.m. Been standing outside the hotel for at least 15 minutes now. It's impossible to get a cab, and the journey downtown will take at least 25. I'm going to be late. Still, my senses quicken at the prospect of seeing Jack tonight. It's months since I last saw him, and I'm having trouble calling his face to mind. When I think of him, all I get is a broad smile and a general impression of ease and happiness. It's a fabulous morning, one of those glittering New York days that hurt your heart. Incredible rain last night has given everything a remarkable windscreen-wiped clarity. As we reach the bottom of Fifth, I see the buildings of the financial district quiver with the slight watery shimmer that comes from the play of condensation and light and glass. 8:59 a.m. Brokers Dickinson Bishop are on the 21st floor. My stomach does an Olga Corbett flick-flack in the elevator on the way up. Jerry, a beaming fellow with a broad Irish face and straggly red sideburns, meets me at the landing. I tell him I need 45 minutes and a place to show slides.
Sorry, you got 5, lady. Things are pretty crazy in there.
He heaves open a thick wooden door and unleashes the sounds of an average day at the Coliseum, plus phones. men bawling into receivers, fighting to make themselves heard, or shouting out instructions across the room. Just as I'm wondering whether to make a run for it, a message comes over the PA.
Okay, listen up, you guys. In 2 minutes, Miss Kate Reddy of London, England, will be talking to you about international investing.
About 70 brokers gather round, mastiff-necked New Yorkers in those terrible shirts with the white collars and the marquee stripes. They lean back against the desks, arms crossed, legs apart, the way that kind of man stands. Some carry on trading, but pull down their headpieces to lend me half an ear. There is no way I'm going to be seen or heard down here, so I take a split-second decision to stand on a desk and shout my wares.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm here to tell you why you must buy my fund.
Cheers, whistles, the closest I'll ever get to being a pole dancer, I guess.
Hey, miss, anyone ever tell you you look like Princess Di? Is your stock as good as your legs?
What strikes me about these masters of the universe is how hopelessly, helplessly boyish they are. In 1944, they would have been landing on the beaches of Normandy, and here they are, gathered round me as if I were their company commander. I give them the big speech about the money, the way it's awake when I'm asleep, the way it moves around the world, its amazing power. Then they fire questions at me.
What do you think about Russia, ma'am? Isn't Russia money the pits? Did you see a euro yet?
It's gone well. Unbelievably well. At the lift, a grinning Jerry tells me the guys normally only get that fired up for a Knicks game. I should really go back to the hotel and pick up my messages, but I walk for a while along Wall Street, feeling plugged into the power supply. On the corner of Maiden Lane and Broadway, I hail a cab and take it uptown to Barney's for some post-traumatic shopping. The store has an immediate consoling effect. I take the little lift to the top floor, where I spot an evening dress. I don't need an evening dress. I try it on. Black and floaty, with a fragile braid of diamante fixed down each side and in a plunging V under the bust, it's the kind of dress they once danced to Charleston in. I just about have the figure for it. I just don't have the life. My life is the wrong size. There's no room in it for a dress this beautiful. But isn't that part of the thrill? Buying a dress and hoping the life to go with it will follow soon like a must-have accessory. When the girl at the till hands me the chit to sign, I don't even check the amount. 3 p.m. The hotel room is like 100 I've stayed in before. The wallpaper is beige, embossed on beige. The curtains, in bold contrast, look like an explosion in a herbaceous border. I check the minibar for emergency chocolate, and then the drawer of the bedside table. There is the Gideon Bible, and a more contemporary touch, a collection of sayings from the world's great religions. I check my watch. The time difference with England is 5 hours. If I call now, it should be around the kids' bedtime. I'm expecting to hear Richard's voice, but it's Paula at the other end. She says Rich has asked her to stay over a couple of nights until I get back, and left a note for me that he made her promise to deliver in person. Where the hell is he? I ask Paula to open the note and read it to me. Just look at the time. I think of all the things my husband could be doing to help out while I'm not there, as our nanny starts to read his words aloud. I've been trying to talk to you for a while now, but I find it increasingly hard to get your attention.
Yes, but does it say what time he'll be back?
Kate, can you hear me? Are you listening?
Of course I can hear you, Paula.
No, that's Richard, in the note. He says, Kate, can you hear me? Are you listening?
Oh, right, sorry. Go on.
I am so sorry, my darling, that we have reached this terrible imp...
What imp?
Ass.
Oh, for heaven's sake. How do you spell it?
Paula announces each letter carefully. I-M-P-A-S-S-E.
Oh, impasse. I see. It's French for... Well, anyway, what else?
Paula sounds dubious. I'm not sure I should be doing this, Kate.
No, please carry on. I have to know what his plans are.
He says, if you need to get hold of me, I will be staying at David and Mariah's for a few nights until I find a place of my own. He says, don't worry, I'll still go and pick Emily up from school.
So it really can happen then? In real life? A thing you've seen in bad TV drama and turned over because it's so implausible. Only this time there is no turning over and maybe no turning back. One moment the world is pretty much as it should be, rocky and a little barren perhaps, but still the world as you know it, and then suddenly you have the sensation of the ground giving way beneath your feet. My husband, Richard the Rational, Richard the Reliable, Richard the Rock, has left me. Rich, who in the letter he gave me the day before our wedding wrote, I'm ever, and you're ready. Here's to long life, my darling, has walked out, and I have been paying so little attention that our nanny has ended up breaking the news. During the long pause, Paula's breathing has got heavier. There is a wheeze of anxiety coming down the line.
Kate, she asks, are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Please, Paula, sleep in our bed. As I say the words, it occurs to me that it may be my bed now, not ours. The children go there first in the morning. I know this is asking an awful lot, Paula, but if you could just hold the fort. And if you can please tell Emily and Ben that Mummy will be back as soon as she can tomorrow. Paula doesn't reply at once, and I think if she lets me down now, I don't know what I'll do.
Is that all right, Paula? Oh, sorry, Kate. I've just seen there's a P.S. on the other side. Richard says, I know I can never stop loving you because, believe me, I've tried.
There is no possible reply to that. And into my silence, Paula murmurs,
don't worry, I'll take care of everything here. Ben and Em will be fine. It's going to be all right, Kate. Really it is.
After I've put the phone down, I forget how to breathe for a few seconds. Suddenly, the mechanics of taking in air seem complicated and strenuous. I have to heave my diaphragm up and then pump my chest out, heave and pump again. When I'm a little steadier, I call Jack and leave a message on his mobile cancelling dinner. Then I get undressed and take a shower. The towels are that hopeless Italian kind, thin and frugal as an altar cloth. They pat the water round your skin rather than absorbing it. I need a towel that can hug me. Catching sight of myself in the bathroom mirror, I am startled to see that I look much as I did the last time I looked. Why isn't my hair falling out? Why aren't my eyes weeping blood? I think of my children asleep in their beds and of how far I am from them, how unbelievably far. From this distance, I see my little family as a small encampment on a hillside, and the winds are lashing round them, and I have to be there to tie everything down. I have to be there. The water is wide, I cannot get o'er, and neither have I wings to fly. I climb into bed between the stiff white sheets and move my hand over my body. My body, and for so long Richard's body. With this body I thee worship. I try to think of the last time I saw him. Saw him properly, I mean. Not just the way you see a blur in the rearview mirror. In the past few months, I go out and he takes over, or he leaves and I take over. We swap instructions in the hall. We say Emily has eaten a good lunch, so don't worry too much about her tea. We say Ben needs an early night because he wouldn't take a nap this afternoon. We say bowel movements have been successful or are still pending, and perhaps some prunes would help. Or else we leave notes. Sometimes we barely meet each other's eyes. Kate and Richard, like a relay team where each runner suspects the other of being the weaker link, but the main thing is to keep running round the track so the baton can be exchanged and the race can go on and on. Oh, love is handsome and love is kind, and love's a jewel when it is new, but when it is old it groweth cold and fades away like morning dew.
Mummy, I know why you get cross with Daddy,
Emily said to me the other morning. Why?
Because he does wrong things.
I knelt down beside her so I could look straight into her eyes. It felt important to set the record straight. No, sweetheart. Daddy doesn't do wrong things. Mummy just sometimes gets very tired, and that makes her not patient with Daddy. That's all.
Patient means wait a minute, she said.
I pick up sayings of the world's great religions from the bedside table and flick through it. There are sections on belief, justice, and education. I pause at the one on marriage. I have never called my wife, wife, but home, the Talmud. Home. I look at the word for a long time. Home. Hear its rounded center. Picture what it means. I am married, but I'm not a wife. Have children, but I'm not a mother. What am I? I know a woman who is so afraid of her children's need for her that, rather than go home after work, she sits in the wine bar to wait until they're asleep. I know a woman who wakes her baby at 5:30 every morning so she can have some time with him. I know a woman who went on a TV discussion program and talked about doing the school run. Her nanny told me she barely knew where her kid's school was. I know a woman who heard down the phone from a babysitter that her baby took his first steps. And I know a woman who found out that her husband left her from a note that was read out to her by her nanny. I lie there for a long time in the bed, maybe hours, waiting until I start to feel something. And finally it comes, a feeling both intensely familiar and shockingly strange. It takes me a few seconds to know what it is. I want my mother. Chapter 34. Home to Mum. However hard I search, I can't come up with a memory of my mother sitting down. Always standing. Standing at the sink holding a pan under running water. Standing by the ironing board. Standing at the school gate in her good navy coat, bringing in plates of hot food from the kitchen and then clearing them away again. Common sense suggests there must have been an interval between bringing the plates in and taking them out when she sat down and ate with us, but I don't remember it. Dishes, once they were let out of cupboards, became a mess to my mother, and a mess needed clearing up. You could still be in mid-forkful, but if the plate looked empty, Mum would whisk it away. My mother's generation was born for service. It was their vocation and their destiny. The gap between school, routine, things you do because you must, bad smells, and motherhood, routine, things you do because you must, bad smells, was a matter of a few years. Those 50s girls had a window of freedom, but the window was seldom wide enough to climb through, and anyway, what would become of them if they got out? Women like my mum didn't expect much of life, and in general, life did not disappoint them. Even when the men they served ran out on them, or died too early from strokes and disorders of the stomach, they often stayed at their posts, preparing meals, hoovering, grabbing any ironing that was going from their children or grandchildren, and never sitting down if they could possibly help it. It was as though they defined themselves in doing for others, and the loss of that definition left them blurred, confused, like the pit ponies who kept their tunnel vision long after they had been let loose in a field. For my generation, coming to it later, and sometimes too late, motherhood was a shock. Sacrifice wasn't written into our contract. After 15 years as an independent adult, the sudden lack of liberty could be as stunning as being parted from a limb. Entwined with the intense feeling of love for your baby was a thin thread of loss, and maybe we will always ache like an amputee. What my mum still calls women's liberation had just about taken off by the time I was born, but it never reached the parts where my parents lived, and, to a remarkable extent, still hasn't. If you live in London and read only certain newspapers, you would think that equality was a done deal, not some futuristic experiment still under scrutiny in select laboratories by men in white coats. One summer, my mother grew her perm out and had her hair cut short in a feathery style that flattered her elfin features. Julie and I loved it. She looked so pretty and cheeky. But when my dad came in that night, he said,
"It's a bit women's lib, Jean."
And the style was grown out without fuss, without any more needing to be said. As I entered my teens, it occurred to me that things were not what they seemed. Although the men round our way took all the leading roles, it was the women who were running the show. But they were never allowed to be on stage. It was a matriarchy pretending to be a patriarchy to keep the lads happy. I always thought that was because where I came from, people didn't get much of an education. Now I think that's what the whole world's like, only some places hide it better than others. In the playground, the children's cries fill the air like starlings. The school is a red brick building with tall, churchy windows, dating from an era when people had faith both in God and education. Over in the far corner, next to the climbing frame, there is a woman in a navy three-quarter coat bending down. When she straightens up, I can see she is holding a handkerchief, which is attached to the bloody nose of a small girl. My mother is a nursery school assistant. She's been here for years now, and basically she runs the place, but they still call her an assistant. Because they can get away with it, Mum doesn't like to make a fuss, and because it means they can pay her less. The money's terrible. When she told me how much, I shouted with dismay. I could blow it on cab fares in 3 days. But if you use words like exploitation, my mother just laughs. Says she likes the job, it gets her out of the house. Besides, she has a way with children. If your 3-year-old had a bleeding nose, believe me, you'd want my mother to be the one holding her hand. Jean Reddy is one of those souls who exude comfort like a human hot water bottle. When she looks across the yard, she knows it's me instantly, but it takes another second before the pleasure floods into her face. "Oh, Kathy, love," she says, coming over with the wounded tot in tow. "What a lovely surprise. I thought you were in America." "I was. Got back a couple of days ago." When I kiss her cheek, it's apple cold. "Now, Lauren," my mother says, addressing the sniffling child, "this is my little girl. Say hello." The ringing bell signals the end of Mum's shift, and we go indoors to fetch her bag from the staff room. In the corridor, she introduces me to Val, the headmistress of the primary school. "Oh, yes, Catherine, we've heard so much about you. Jean showed me the cutting in the paper. You've done very well for yourself, haven't you?" I'm eager to get out of here, but my mother enjoys showing me off. The hand she puts on my arm as she steers me between colleagues reminds me of Emily at World Feast Day, parading Mummy in front of her friends. Parked in front of the school, the Volvo is filled with kids' stuff. "How are they?" Mum asks as we climb in. I tell her they're fine and with Paula. On the drive to the flat, we pass my old school, and she sighs. "Did you hear about Mr. Dowling? Terrible." "He took early retirement, didn't he?" "Yes." "Alas! Can you imagine a young lass doing something like that, Kath?" Mr. Dowling was my head of history 20 years ago. A blinky, soft-spoken man with a vast enthusiasm for Elizabethan England and the poetry of the First World War. A few months ago, some little cow in the fifth form punched his glasses into his face, and he took early retirement soon after. Mr. Dowling, an archetypal grammar school boy, had become one of the casualties of the comprehensive system. A doctrine of equality, which means that all the kids round here who want to learn something are in classes with kids who don't. "They'll expect you to have read widely, Catherine, but we've very little time," Mr. Dowling said to me when he was preparing me for Cambridge entrance. "I was the only one in my year, the only one for as long as anyone could remember, except Michael Brain, who got to Oxford to read law and was now at the bar, which we were told had nothing to do with pubs. It was after school in Mr. Dowling's office off the library, with the electric fire with just one bar working. I loved being in there with him, reading and hearing the click of the filaments. We did the Chartists in a day, the First World War in a weekend."
"You won't know everything, but I think we can give an impression of you knowing the ground," my teacher said.
But I had the famous ready memory. England under the Tudors and Stuarts, the Ottoman Empire, witchcraft. I had the dates of battles down pat, the way my father memorized the pools, Corunna, Bosworth, Ypres, Raith Rovers, Brecon City, Swindon Town. We could wing anything, Dad and me, if we thought it would pay. Walking up the steps to take my seat alone in the exam room, I knew I could do it, if I could only hold the knowledge in there for long enough. Must remember. Nice cup of tea. And I'll do some sandwiches, shall I? Ham all right? Mum is busying herself with the kettle in the kitchen of the flat. More an alcove than a kitchen. There's room for only one person in there. I never want to eat the sandwiches, but a couple of years ago I had one of those maturity leaps when I realized that eating wasn't the point. My mother's sandwiches were there to give her something she could do for me when there is so much she can't do anymore. Overnight, her need to be needed seemed more important than my need to get away. I sit down at the formica table with the fold-down flaps, the table that sat in all the kitchens of my childhood. It has a black scab gouged out of the side by a furious Julie after a row with Dad over finishing her rutabaga. As I eat, Mum puts up the ironing board and starts to work her way through the basket of clothes at her feet. The room is soon filled with the drowsy, comforting smell of baked water. The iron makes little exasperated puffs as it travels the length of a blouse or gets its snout into a tricky cuff. My mother is a champion ironer. It's a pleasure to watch her hand move an inch or so ahead of the little steam train, smoothing its path. She smooths and smooths, and then she snaps the cloth taut like a conjurer, and finally she folds. Arms of a shirt folded behind like a man under arrest. As I watch her, my eyes go swimmy. I think that after she's gone, there'll be no one who will ever do that for me again. No one who will iron my clothes taking such infinite pains. What's that over your eye, love? Nothing. She comes over and lifts my fringe to get a better view of the eczema, and I blink back the tears. I know you're nothing's, Catherine Reddy. She laughs. Have you got some cream off the doctor for it? Yes. No. Have you got it anywhere else? No. Yes, in a flaming, itching belt around my middle, behind my ears, behind my knees. In my pocket, the mobile begins to thrum. I take it out and check the number. Rod Task. I switch the phone off. What have I told you about looking after yourself? I don't know how you manage with work on at you the whole time. Mum jabs her finger in the direction of the mobile. And the kiddies as well. It's no life. Back behind the ironing board, she says, And how's our Richard keeping? I give a crummy mumble. I've come all the way up here to tell her that Rich has gone. I hated the idea of leaving the kids with Paula so soon after getting back from the States, but if I put my foot down, I can do the journey here and back in a day. And I didn't want Mum to find out that Richard and I were separated, as I did, down the phone. But now I'm here, I can't quite find the words. Oh, by the way, my husband left me because I haven't paid attention to him since 1994. She'd think I was joking. Richard's a good man, she says, trapping a pillowcase on the curved end of the board. You want to hang on to him, love. They don't come much better than Richard. In the past, I have taken my mother's enthusiasm for my man as a sign of its opposite for me. Her exclaiming over another of his supposed